different gene in the genome. Okay, so by simply changing the sequence here, you could change, you know, without changing the output, you could change what the, sorry, without changing the input, you could change what the output will be, because the output is always the expression of a gene, which is downstream from that particular sequence of DNA. And people have shown that that is actually happening, and it happens quite often, because there is a highly modular relationship between the elements that control in the DNA the expression of a gene and the gene itself. So in other words, evolution can very easily change this, for instance, from this to that or from this to that, without changing the gene. And all you're doing is changing what input is going to lead to the particular output you have. And of course, the opposite is also true. You can change the gene without changing the regulatory element on the DNA. So now the same input will simply lead to the expression of a different gene. Okay? And to give you some examples, people have shown already that, for instance, in this fish, it's called stickleback fish. So in this fish, the presence or absence of these spikes, shown down here, depends on one particular sequence of DNA that controls the expression of a single gene. And evolution has changed that repeatedly so that you have, you know, variants of that fish that won't have the spike or will have the spike depending on one particular sequence of DNA that controls the expression of a gene. The same is true for all these wings of butterflies that I'm showing here, where people have shown in multiple examples that the particular pattern of pigmentation depends on the presence or the absence of one of a number of particular DNA regulatory elements that control the expression of a protein that produces the pigment. Okay? So depending on whether you have one or two or many different of these regulatory elements, there's going to be a number of signals that will lead to the expression of that pigment-producing protein in some places in the wing and not in others. Now, this is all very interesting, but in a sense, if evolution were only to change by changing what DNA elements control the expression of a gene, evolution will be constrained in itself to changes in processes that take a certain amount of time. And the reason is that since the moment you have a signal, an input, that, you know, binds to a receptor in a signaling network, until the moment where this gene is expressed, there is a delay. And that delay is usually not caused by the signaling network itself, but rather by the time that it takes to express the gene, export the RNA out of the nucleus, produce the protein in the ribosome, fold that protein, and that protein probably has to go somewhere in the cell to become functional. That takes time. Okay, what is a long time in cellular processes is, well, maybe 5 minutes, okay, maybe 10 minutes, since the signal arrives to the cell until you have the protein functional in somewhere in the cell. So how is evolution going to change processes that require timescales that are much faster than 10 minutes? Okay, so our approach or our ideas are that if actually what you want to change is something in this process that requires a faster timescale, so rather than changing the regulatory elements in the DNA that control the expression of the gene, what you will have to do is changing interactions between these components. Because one aspect that I have to emphasize here is that the output of a signaling pathway is not just expression of a gene, but many other things that happen without the need for gene expression. So the simple concept here is that if you want to make changes that are faster, okay, all you need to do is change the relationship between the different proteins in that signaling pathway without the need to change regulatory sequences at the DNA level. Now, to understand that, I'm going to take a minute to explain a little bit about how proteins work, okay? And we all need to know here that for proteins to be functional, they have to fall. They need to have a particular three-dimensional structure. That three-dimensional structure is what determines what the protein or the enzyme will do. Now, proteins are usually composed not by one particular structure, but by a number of little pieces that we call domains, each one with one particular three-dimensional structure. Okay? So for instance, here I'm showing a protein that has two domains. Now, in this example, one of the domains has a catalytic activity. It's an enzyme. It can do, I don't know, it can hydrolyze a peptide bond. It can you know, phosphorylate something. It can dephosphorylate something. It doesn't really matter, but it's an enzyme. It does something. Whereas the other domain has a peculiar function, which is controlling the activity of the neighboring domain. So all this domain is doing is receiving an input, and depending on what that input is, it's going to turn on or turn off the catalytic domain, okay? And what we see in signaling proteins is, or in signaling networks is that many, if not most proteins that are involved in signaling cascades or in signaling networks have this particular domain architecture where some domains have catalytic function and some other domains have regulatory functions that basically will decide when and where the catalytic domain will be active. So, in a very similar conceptual way, you could imagine that at the DNA level, you can change the regulatory sequence that controls the expression of a downstream gene and make it evolutionary change that will have a certain time delay respect with when the signal is coming. And at the protein level, you could change what regulatory domain is present with what catalytic domain, so that if you change this relationship, you might change the input-output relationship of this signaling protein, and that's an evolutionary change that will have an effect that is much faster. Because while it takes several minutes since the signal comes in until a gene is expressed, and that's the delay shown here, it takes nothing, milliseconds maybe, from the input binding to a regulatory domain to the activity of the catalytic domain actually changing, okay? So our hypothesis is that, in a sense, signaling proteins, because of the modular nature of the domains that make those signaling proteins, are very similar to transcriptional networks, to transcriptional nodes, where you have a very modular relationship between what controls the input and what controls the output. Okay, so the question that we're trying to ask is nature, is evolution taking advantage of this modularity to actually evolve signaling networks? And if you, for a second, look at natural examples of this, these are all different proteins taken from the genomes of different organisms, you would realize that nature seems to actually be doing that. Because we have a number of domains that have very precise function. These are regulatory domains, and these are catalytic domains. And you see that those regulatory domains or those catalytic domains are found in different genes, in different proteins, in very different combinations. So nature, evolution, seems to be taking advantage of that modularity to actually shuffle somehow regulatory domains with catalytic domains, and hopefully producing new regulatory functions. So the goal of the particular project that I'm going to present today is very simple. We are trying to explore how the shuffling of protein domains, what is the role of the shuffling of protein domains in the evolution of signaling networks, and we are using an experimental approach. So that experimental approach is basically the yeast mating pathway, okay? Yeast are unicellular eukaryotes. So even though they are unicellular, okay, they share a lot of similarities with our cells. And the particular signaling pathways that control the mating ability of yeast cells happen to be very similar to some of the signaling pathways that control the ability of some of our cells to divide. They are similar to the point that you can actually knock out some of the yeast proteins, bring in the human homologs, and the network works as well. So the mating pathway, and again, here, you don't need to, you know, don't worry about all the names. It doesn't really matter. What's important here is that this is the cell. This is the inside of the cell. There is a membrane that separates the inside of the cell with the outside. And yeast cells come in two different flavors, A cells and alpha cells. It's like females and males for us. Okay? And when these two cells meet, they exchange some pheromones that will activate the signaling pathways in the opposite cell type. Okay? So the mating pheromone, which is shown here, binds to a receptor. And that receptor activates a number of proteins shown here, some of which are going to move away. So these two guys are move away from the receptor when the signal comes. And when they move away, they would actually act to recruit or bind to another protein shown here that will bring together a number of other proteins called kinases here, so that now this top kinase is going to be activated by this other protein, and it will initiate a cascade of events that will lead to the activation of this last protein in the cascade called FAS3. This guy is going to go to the nucleus, and it's going to change the expression of a few hundred genes, and that will lead to the cells actually to mate. So this is our model system. Now, what we've done is we took all these proteins in this pathway, and we look and see which of these proteins are actually made of a single domain, which proteins are actually made of a number of domains, two, three, or more. Okay? And that is shown here. And then remember, what we want to do here is look at how evolution could shuffle domains to change the properties or the dynamic properties of the signaling pathway. So what we did was we took all these genes or all these proteins and we split them. Okay? We took all the genes that have more than two domains and we split them in some arbitrary way. If a protein has a single domain, like these guys here, we did not split them because we know, everybody knows, that if you take a domain and you break it, most likely you're going to destroy the function. Okay? So what we did here was take all these proteins and split them, just making sure, as best as we could, that we were not breaking within domains, but rather in between the domains. Okay? And then what we did was we created a library of new proteins in which we shuffle each one of these domains with each one of these other domains shown here. Okay? So we took each one of these and we create new, like, hybrid genes or hybrid proteins where now this was connected to that or to that or to that, etc. And then we took each one of those chimeric proteins and we put it back in the wild-type yeast. Okay? And then we looked and see how that new gene, that is a recombination of domains coming from different genes, actually changes the function of the network. So the experiment is actually shown here. What we have is we took any of these domains and shuffle it with any of these domains, and the representation of that is what we call a domain recombination, shown here. But we also needed to do a lot of controls, okay? Because every time we take one of these chimeric proteins and put it back in the wild-type strain, we are not replacing a protein, but we actually add in a new protein, okay? So the controls we made include the duplication of every one of these genes without any change, just the whole thing, or the duplication of any one of these little domains without any, without fusing them to other domains, just as they are, plus the co-expression of each pair of domains that we have fused, but without fusing them as two independent proteins, okay? And we did all those experiments, and we looked at the function of the pathway, and then we saw, what happened. So the way we measure the function of the pathway is very simple. Okay? We have this mating pathway with or without extra genes in yeast, and we have a stimulus, which is a mating pheromone, so we add that pheromone to the culture, and we have a gene that is called green fluorescent protein controlled by this pathway. So when you add the pheromone and you wait a few minutes, the cells are starting to express this green fluorescent protein and basically turn green. So if the cell is green, it means that the pathway is being activated. If the cell is not green, it means that something is blocking the activation of that pathway. And because we had to measure this for hundreds of different strains, We try to do it in a very simple way. So we find conditions where this is more or less linear. So then we took measurements to determine the baseline of the pathway activation before we add the stimulus and the slope with which the pathway is activated. And if you think about it, even before doing the experiment, you could predict that there will be a number of possible observations. Okay? There might be things that this is a wild type response. So the wild type response, we have a certain baseline of GFP levels or pathway activity levels and a slope. And of course, there will be a lot of hybrid proteins that when added to the network are not gonna change anything. Those guys are gonna look like wild type, okay? But others might be activating the pathway faster with a higher slope or slower, or they can change the baseline, okay? So what we did was to measure those two parameters for every member of our libraries and compare it to wild type. And then what we did was to plot what we call the response morphospace. So if you're like wild type, you're gonna be here, okay? If your slope is higher than wild type, this is a slope, so your slope will be somewhere there. If your slope is lower, you're gonna be somewhere here. If you change the baseline, you're gonna be here or there. And of course, there could be anything in between. And we measure that for all this, for all the library. And I'm gonna start with some of the controls. What we saw was that if all you do is duplicating the full length protein, so we are not recombining, we are not shuffling any domains. We just take a protein that is already in the pathway and we add an extra copy of that. So when you do that, not too much happens, okay? Most of those clones look like wild type. They are very close to 1-1, which is where the wild type is. If you do the same thing, but now what you're adding are the individual domains. No, we didn't shuffle anything yet. We're just adding the individual domains that we are going to shuffle. This is another control. Again, most of them look like wild type. There's some that are somehow decreasing the slope. So they are kind of, you know, putting the brakes on the activity of the pathway. And we have some ideas of why that might be happening. It's something that in biology we call dominant negatives. We can discuss that later. Now, what's interesting is that when you actually recombine, when you actually shuffle those domains, okay, suddenly you get a number of behaviors that are very different from the wild type, okay? Some activate the pathway way faster, some activate the pathway slower, some have very high baselines, and anything in between. And that depends on those domains that you are shuffling actually being connected, because if you introduce those domains but as two independent proteins without actually connecting them, then what you get is basically something that looks more or less like wild type or the dominant negatives, but all those interesting examples actually disappear. Okay, so from here, what seems to be happening is that it's relatively easy to just take existing domains, shuffling them in any combination, putting it into the wild type network, and voila, you get networks that have different dynamics. Okay, we are always adding the same stimulus, but now the timing of the expression of the output changes. And the mating pathway is actually a very interesting pathway to work with, because so far all we've done was to measure the dynamics with which a reporter gene, green fluorescent protein, is expressed. But when you work with the mating pathway, you can actually measure the full output of the pathway, which is the ability of the cells to mate. So you can take one cell type with the extra proteins that you're adding, plus the other cell type with the wild type pathway, put them together, let them mate, and then measure with what efficiency the different cell types are actually mating. So if you do that, what you will see, and for a minute, you need to focus only on the area of the circle. Okay, the area of the circle gives you an idea of the efficiency with which those different cells are mating. If you are a wild-type cell mating with a wild-type cell, your efficiency is given by the area of this circle. If you are a wild-type cell mating with a cell that has one particular extra domain combination, the names don't really matter at this point, your efficiency for mating is very tiny, okay? If you are any of these particular strains with any of these particular combinations of domains, your efficiency for mating is much higher than the wild type, okay? And what's interesting is that there seems to be some kind of correlation between the slope of the path of the pathway, the baseline of the pathway, and the ability of the cells to mate. It's not perfect, but there's something there. For instance, if your baseline is very high, it means like the pathway is on even though there is no stimulus, okay? If your baseline is very high, but the slope is low, the slope being zero means you don't see the stimulus coming. You're active, but you don't see the stimulus coming, so then you mate very poorly, okay? Whereas if you have a very high slope, means that there is a huge difference for you between receiving the stimulus or not, then you mate better, okay? Now, when we first saw these results, we were kind of, okay, if you can easily in the laboratory evolve a strain of yeast that mates way better than the wild type, why any of this is not the wild type? Because nature had, you know, millions of years to do this experiment. So why are not these guys wild type, right? So the obvious answer to that is that this should be somehow perturbing some other process in the cell. Okay, it's cool, you made better, but you're paying a price somewhere else, right? So when biologists have no idea what to look for, what we do is we measure growth rate. Because in a sense, growth rate it's like a proxy for the overall physiology of the cell, okay? So we did that. We took all the guys that made way better than the wild type, and for all of those and the wild type, we measured growth rate. And sorry, this is very tiny, but what's important is that here you have a growth rate, okay? This is the mating efficiency, and the wild type is here. And believe me, the wild type has the highest growth rate. So this is the weird thing with yeast cells. Yeast cells can divide without mating, or they can mate and then divide. So they can basically reproduce in two different ways, asexually by cell division or sexually by mating. So the wild type, even though it's not the best at reproducing sexually, it is the best at reproducing asexually. And that might be the reason why the wild type is a wild type, because in nature, yeast, at least Saccharomyces, the yeast that we use for bread and beer, that's the one we are using here. In nature, they most of the time, they reproduce asexually, okay? We have some reasons. We have some, there's many experiments that suggest why the wild type is, why these mutations are affecting growth rate, but we are not getting into that. We did some simple simulations. Whoops. It looks much better on the computer. So I skip that, but the point we're trying to make in the simulations is that depending on how often you mate or how often you reproduce asexually, you're going to be, you know, a wild type will be winning in some situations and some of the mutants are going to be winning in some other situations, but it's not that important. Now, let's for a second talk about the mechanism. How are these things actually working? Because we are adding things, we are looking proteins to the network, and some of those are changing the way the network works. So what is the molecular mechanism for that? So we know that the wild type pathway is basically made of three complexes of proteins. There's four proteins here, three there, and another five here. When the signal comes, all these guys come together, okay? Basically, all the kinases that are shown here are recruited to the proximity of the plasma membrane, and that is how the signal is activated. So when we looked at the new proteins that somehow were affecting the function of the network, remember, not all of them did, but 15% of our libraries affected the network, what we saw was that those that were affecting the network were proteins where we were somehow enriching interactions between these modules, and those are shown as the green lines here. The black lines are the interactions that are already in the wild type. The green lines are the new interactions in the libraries, that in those clones that somehow affected the function of the network. So what we see is that we are enriching in new interactions that connect the modules rather than in interactions that connect components within the modules. And if you think about the molecular mechanism, so I have this little cartoon that will kind of help us understand what's happening. So when the mating pheromone binds to the receptor, the first thing that happens is that these two proteins move away from the receptor. There is some molecular conformational change here that basically pushes these two guys away, the binding between these two proteins and this protein is lost. That exposes a surface on this protein, okay, and a surface on this protein that will serve to recruit some of these other components. So the one thing that's going to happen is that this protein that is called usually the scaffold will bind to this. Then this adaptor protein will bind to this other one here. One of the kinases will bind to both of them. Another kinase will bind to the close to the membrane to this protein, and that's going to send the first signal. So this guy now, because it's bound to this, is activated and can activate the downstream kinase. Okay? Before, it was inactive because one of the regulatory domains was controlling the activity. Once it binds, now the regulatory domain tells the catalytic domain, now you can go. So the catalytic domain will act on this kinase. And once the two other kinases bind to the scaffold, the signal is going to be propagated downstream. This guy is going to go and phosphorylate hundreds of other proteins in the cell, and the cell is going to mate. Okay, so that's a wild type. So what are our hybrid proteins doing? Well, what we think is happening is that each one of them is somehow rewiring some of these interactions. Okay? So for instance, this particular combination of domains has a very high baseline, okay, and it's still able to activate the pathway when the signal comes. What we think is happening is that this particular combination of domains is creating this weird rewiring, where this domain is now directly bound to this protein here. Okay, so this is a wild type, this is a mutant. Okay, this domain is now directly connected here, so it can bridge, okay, between this kinase and the substrate downstream in a different way. It doesn't look like wild type, but it somehow manages to make to bridge the gap here, and the signal either, you know, is still able to flow. This is another example. This combination of domains has a huge activation, okay? And what we think is happening is that, again, this domain, the kinase domain of this protein, is now directly linked to the scaffold, okay? This is now directly linked to the scaffold, as shown here, and it can be recruited directly by the scaffold. So again, it can be activated probably very fast. The fact that this is faster than this suggests that this recruitment is probably faster than the need for all this large complex to actually form. But that's an hypothesis. Now, another example here, another way to rewire. Okay, in this example, this kinase domain is now directly recruited to this via the interaction with this domain from the other kinase. Okay, again, there's alternative ways in which we can rewire the wild-type pathway, ways in which you still have, the signal flowing. Now, so far, all we've done was to add a protein to the network. We are not replacing proteins. We are adding a new protein to the network. So then what we ask, and this is something that is ongoing in my lab now, is what happens when you actually don't add a protein, but actually you replace a protein in the network for any of these hybrid proteins that we made? And when that happens, let me skip that. So when that happens, very often you still get a wild-type behavior, even though you're actually removing a protein from the original network and replacing it with a protein that is different. And here we have two examples of that. So this is pathway activation for a number of different strains. This is the wild type, okay? This is the activity you get before you add the signal, the mating pheromone. This is the activity you get after you add the signal. This is what happens if you knock out this kinase, okay? You knock out, you remove that gene, and then the ability of the pathway to activate disappears. But if on top of that you're actually adding some of the hybrid proteins that we found before, then you recover somehow a behavior that looks more or less like wild type. Okay, and these are two ways in which these two different hybrid proteins might be acting. Again, as I said before, they might be creating new interactions that are not identical to the wild type interactions, but somehow can still, connect all that needs to be connected, and you get a signal that it looks very much like wild type. And we did that for a number of genes. I'm not going to get into that, into the details. But this is ongoing work in the lab. But it looks amazing because basically you can knock out, you can remove almost every single gene in the network, and you will still find a way to replace that gene by a hybrid of other components so that the signal will probably not look identical like wild type, but will still be able to flow. Okay, so this is an example where we knock out the scaffold and we have a number of clones that somehow can still signal. This is an example where we knocked out the upstream kinase, and this is kind of puzzling because you have a lot of ways to actually bypass the need for that kinase and still be able to signal. And this is an interesting example because what we are knocking out here is a protein that is downstream of all this large complex, and that is much more difficult to actually bypass. The only clone so far we found that bypasses that actually includes a portion of it. So it seems like it's one example in which rewiring, it's a bit more difficult. Okay? So with that, I'm just going to conclude. And what we found, and I think this is the most take-home message for this, is that proteins seem to be very modular. And you can easily recombine those modules, those protein domains, and find new combinations of modules that will still be able to signal, and what's more interesting, will signal with the dynamics that is different from the original network. So in a sense, what we are saying is that for evolution to change the dynamics of the activation of a signaling network, you don't need to reinvent anything. You don't need to create a new function. All you need to do is take the genes that are there in the genome, shuffle them in some random way, and you are bound to find some that are going to rewire the signaling network with interesting properties. And we also think that the particular network we chose, and we were very lucky with that, seems to be very plastic because these last results I show you, where we actually don't add a protein but replace a protein, we thought that most of those are going to be dead, and it doesn't seem to be the case. It seems to be a pathway that is extremely plastic. Okay, it's very easy to evolve. Now, we've done similar experiments with a different pathway that controls a different input-output relationship, and the results there were very different. That pathway seems to be much harder to rewire. Okay, and that's a pathway that controls the response of the cell to stress, and what might be telling us is that stress is something that is more difficult to rewire because if the cells are not able to respond properly to the stress we are applying, which is high osmolarity, the cells die. So that pathway might have a lot of extra elements of control to ensure that the cells don't die. Whereas here, all you're doing is changing the ability of the cells to mate, and that seems to be something that is more tolerated. And with that, I just want to thank people that was involved in that. This is a story that started when I was at UCSF, and it's been continued by a couple of students in my lab. And I thank you for your attention.